Section 2. Overcoming the 5 Dysfunctions of a Team. Okay, this is the meat of the book, the part where I go through the dysfunctions and explain what they mean, how you can help your team overcome them, and which tools and exercises my colleagues and I find to be most useful. A detailed explanation of the tools and exercises mentioned in these segments can be found in Section 4. Overcoming Dysfunction Number 1. Building Trust. Based on my experience working with teams during the past 10 years or so, I've come to one inescapable conclusion. No quality or characteristic is more important than trust. In fact, my work with teams revolves around trust more than any other topic, and that's why this is the longest, most important section in this book. Unfortunately, there is probably no quality or characteristic that is as rare as trust either. But I suppose that's good news for your team, because if you can be the first on your block to build trust, the possibility of achieving a real competitive advantage is great. So why is trust so rare? 2 reasons. First, people use the word inconsistently, and so trust means different things to different people. Second, because it's just plain hard. Let's start by defining what we mean by trust, and the best way to do that is to clarify what trust is not. Defining trust. Trust is not the ability of team members to predict one another's behaviors because they've known each other for a long time. Even the most dysfunctional teams, or families for that matter, can learn to forecast one another's words and actions based on observable patterns over a long period of time. So when, for example, a person says, "I trust that Bob will start swearing at me if I mention his inability to arrive at a meeting on time," know that this is not the kind of trust I'm talking about. When it comes to teams, trust is all about vulnerability. Team members who trust one another learn to be comfortable being open, even exposed to one another around their failures, weaknesses, even fears. Now, if this is beginning to sound like some get-naked, touchy-feely theory, rest assured that it is nothing of the sort. Vulnerability-based trust is predicated on the simple and practical idea that people who aren't afraid to admit the truth about themselves are not going to engage in the kind of political behavior that wastes everyone's time and energy, and more important, makes the accomplishment of results an unlikely scenario. Here's an example of how damaging a lack of trust can be in an organization. The invulnerable leader story. I once worked with a large company, one that if you haven't used their products, you've certainly heard of, that demonstrated how a lack of trust can destroy years of hard work and accomplishment. Let's call the company Passivity. Passivity had been a highly respected and accomplished company over the years, but had recently fallen on hard times at the hands of a larger, more aggressive competitor. Still, the company had legions of dedicated customers and employees, if not Wall Street analysts. Enter the new CEO of Passivity, a man who neither valued nor elicited trust among his executive team. As the company, under the guidance of its new leader, watched its demise accelerate, journalists and industry watchers attributed the spiral to unwise decisions about products and strategy. And while those decisions certainly contributed to the problem, they were merely symptoms of a bigger issue. That issue could only be observed behind the scenes at executive staff meetings. It was there that a tornado of distrust was raging, leaving in its wake a sea of bad decisions and real human suffering, not to mention drowning stock options. As is often the case, the trust vacuum emanated from the leader, a brilliant man whose intelligence was rivaled only by his inability to acknowledge his own limitations. This was made apparent to me and the rest of his team on many occasions, but none more painfully so than when he reluctantly shared the results of his 360-degree feedback during a staff meeting. Standing before his team, with his 360-degree report in his hands, the leader of passivity started by addressing his weaknesses. "It says here that I'm not a good listener," he announced with a puzzled look on his face. What do you guys think?" After a brief and awkward moment of silence, the executives around the table assured their boss that he was not a bad listener at all, and that he was indeed better than many of the other leaders they had known. He accepted their reassurance without a fight. "Okay, what about this next one? It says I don't give enough praise." Again, one by one, the team shrugged and nodded their assurance that this was not really a problem. It was at that moment that I kindly reminded the team that they were, in fact, the only people who had completed the 360-degree survey, and that someone had to have given the CEO low scores in these areas. After an awkward pause, a lone, brave soul raised his hand. "Okay, I'll admit it. I think you could give a little more positive feedback," he offered almost apologetically. "I mean, my people don't usually hear anything from you unless they've screwed up. It would be nice if we or they knew what they were doing well." After yet another awkward moment, one of the other executives in the room declared, in the direction of the CEO, "I don't see it. I think you give more praise than most CEOs I know." This set off a wave of head nodding, leaving the lone brave soul out in the cold, wondering why he'd bothered telling the truth. As humorously pathetic as this example may seem, I am afraid to admit that it actually happened, proving again that truth is stranger than fiction. What it illustrates is the difficulty that people have in admitting their weaknesses, their faults, their mistakes, even when there is real data indicating otherwise. Of course, the real point of this story is not what actually happened that day. It is what it created. The members of that team learned a lesson. Don't be vulnerable. After all, if the CEO isn't capable of being honest about his own issues, why should his direct reports fess up about theirs? And so the executives at passivity learned to engage in a remarkable game of masquerade, pretending to know things that they didn't, and to search for solutions to their problems only in places that wouldn't reflect poorly on them or their departments. Remarkably, as the company's results tanked, the resilience of the leader's invulnerability held firm. Today, the company is a shell of what it once was, having lost most of its leaders and many of the employees who built the firm. A few years ago, it was sold to another company and exists now in name only. When journalists write the epitaphs of companies like passivity, they cite unwise strategic decisions and product defects. But if they really wanted to understand the root causes of their failure, they would look at the inability of executive team members to be vulnerable with one another, to build trust. The difficulty of vulnerability-based trust. The second reason why vulnerability-based trust is so rare is that it is just plain hard to achieve, even when teams understand the definition. That's because human beings, especially the adult variety, have this crazy desire for self-preservation. The idea of putting themselves at risk for the good of others is not natural, and is rarely rewarded in life, at least not in the ways that most people expect. So we learn things like look out for number one, or don't let him see you sweat, or whatever other cliché calls for us to think of ourselves before others. And while this may be wise counsel if you're in prison, on a team, it's lethal. The key to all of this, then, is to teach team members to get comfortable being exposed to one another, unafraid to honestly say things like, I was wrong, and I made a mistake, and I need help, and I'm not sure, and you're better than I am at that, and yes, even I'm sorry. If team members cannot bring themselves to readily speak these words when the situation calls for it, they aren't going to learn to trust one another. Instead, they're going to waste time and energy thinking about what they should say and wondering about the true intentions of their peers. Now, as hard as it is to achieve vulnerability-based trust, it is entirely doable. And better yet, it doesn't have to take a lot of time. In fact, I've seen remarkable distrust on teams that have worked together for years and years, and I've seen teams that have been together for 6 months develop amazing amounts of trust. No, the key ingredient is not time. It is courage. For a team to establish real trust, team members, beginning with the leader, must be willing to take risks without a guarantee of success. They will have to be vulnerable without knowing whether that vulnerability will be respected and reciprocated. Tools and exercises. The Personal Histories Exercise. As in most self-improvement programs, it's best to start small. The point of the first exercise is simply to help people get comfortable with moderate vulnerability. My colleagues and I have done it with virtually every team we work with, and I have to admit, I'm always worried that it's not going to work. And every time, it does. Here's how it goes. At a staff meeting, or off-site, go around the room and have every member of the team explain three things: where they grew up, how many kids were in their family, and what was the most difficult or important challenge of their childhood. But not their inner childhood, just the most important challenge of being a kid. Now, I mentioned that I'm always afraid the exercise is not going to work. And I suppose that's because I think that most people who work on teams already know one another and are not going to learn anything new from this exercise. And then, 20 minutes later, I always find that people are shocked about what they didn't know about their peers. I've heard the most amazing stories during the personal histories exercise. Like the one about the guy who grew up in Chicago and didn't have indoor plumbing. This was in the 60s. And the guy who moved out of his home at age 13 and started a business. And then there are the numerous people who moved around their entire lives, or grew up without parents, or had 8 siblings, or none. Personal History Story Number 1. I worked with a team that had been together for a number of years, and when it came time for one particular guy to explain his biggest challenge of childhood, he hesitated for a moment and then explained that when he was 8 years old, his 12-year-old brother was murdered, and that was tough on him. One of his teammates sitting across the table from this guy was stunned, and after a moment said, I've worked with you for 9 years, and I never heard about that. To which his colleague said, yeah, I was just never sure about the right time to bring it up. In case you're wondering whether this exercise is designed to provide me with some sort of fodder for cocktail parties, let me be clear about the purpose. When team members reveal aspects of their personal lives to their peers, they learn to get comfortable being open with them about other things. They begin to let down their guard about their strengths, weaknesses, opinions, and ideas. And if this sounds manipulative, well, I guess it is. But in a good kind of way. Like when I coax my son to sit in the shallow end of the pool so that he gets comfortable with the idea of going deeper and deeper until he swims. People need to feel the gradual progress of opening up to their peers before diving in too deep. Asking them to be too vulnerable too quickly is not only unfair, it often provokes a resistance that is hard to overcome later. Which is why I don't throw my son in the deep end of the pool cold turkey, I suppose. Now, there's another side benefit to the personal histories exercise. In addition to helping people open up, it helps everyone else overcome one of the great destroyers of teamwork. The fundamental attribution error is simply this. Human beings tend to falsely attribute the negative behaviors of others to their character, an internal attribution, while they attribute their own negative behaviors to their environment, an external attribution. Why? Because we like to believe that we do bad things because of the situations we are in, but somehow we easily come to the conclusion that others do bad things because they are predisposed to being bad. Similarly, we often attribute other people's success to their environment and our own success to our character. That's because we like to believe that we are inherently good and talented, while others are merely lucky, beneficiaries of good fortune. By going through the personal histories exercise, team members come to understand one another at a more fundamental level. They learn how they became the people they are today. As a result, there is a far greater likelihood that empathy and understanding will trump judgment and accusation when it comes to interpreting questionable behavior. Personal history story number 2. I once worked with a woman who didn't seem to get along with her peers on an executive team. She rarely smiled or made eye contact. Her colleagues had come to the conclusion that she didn't like them, and that she didn't want to collaborate with them, until we did the personal histories exercise. "Okay," she began cautiously. "I grew up the only child of a 3-star general, who was a rigid disciplinarian. We lived overseas for most of my childhood. I became a world-class concert violinist, but whenever I received recognition or awards for my music, my dad would try to knock me down a peg or two so that I didn't get a big head." It was as though she had just revealed she was a Martian. Suddenly, everyone now had something they could attribute her behavior to, other than her dislike for them. For instance, when the CFO of a company questions an item on an employee's expense report, colleagues on an executive team might jump to the conclusion that the motivation is one of control or lack of trust. When those colleagues understand, for instance, that the CFO grew up in a poor family or with extremely conservative parents, they might be more likely to understand the real motivation. That's not to say they won't question the CFO and lobby for more resources, but it is to say that they'll do it with a fairer and more accurate understanding of where their colleague is coming from. One of the keys to making the personal histories exercise work is to anticipate the initial objections of team participants. When I introduce the exercise to senior executives, I assure them that I am not interested in their inner child or their deepest, darkest secrets. I also assure them that this is the only exercise we'll do that could even be remotely associated with anything touchy-feely. Then, when they complete the 20-minute assignment, They're pleasantly surprised by its lack of pretension, and more important, by the fact that they understand their peers better than they had just a half hour earlier. Another key to a successful exercise is proper facilitation. This can be a little delicate because the issues at hand are sometimes, well, delicate. For instance, a couple of people out of every 10 we take through the exercise will report that they're unable to think of any difficulties from their childhood. While occasionally this seems to be the result of not wanting to open up to the group, most of the time they seem genuinely stumped. "I just had a wonderful childhood," they'll confess sheepishly. "My parents loved us. We weren't rich or poor. We all got along well." Of course, that's fine. On the other hand, it isn't uncommon that one or two members of a team will disclose something particularly sensitive. The alcoholism of a parent, the death of a sibling or friend, a difficult family relationship. It is important for a facilitator to demonstrate focused listening and respectful appreciation during these moments. Sometimes the best way to do that is to allow a quiet moment to pass after the story. Smile at the person who shared their story and just say thank you. For those of you freaking out right about now as you consider having to hear someone disclose some painful, jarring memory and break out into uncontrollable tears, rest assured that we rarely, no, make that never, have had this occur. No one has said something that was downright inappropriate, and thankfully we've never had someone respond inappropriately either. Human beings, by and large, are good, and other than an occasionally clueless individual, they almost always treat one another with respect. If, and I mean if, someone falls far short of these expectations for being a reasonable human being, might I suggest that you consider whether this isn't a red flag about their overall membership on the team? Just a thought. A few final thoughts on the personal histories exercise. I suppose you can choose different questions to ask, like a person's first job, or worst job, or biggest mistake, or most influential leader in their life. The key is that the questions elicit a response that calls for a person to reveal something personal and relevant, and not silly. Also, it's best if people's responses are relatively similar in length, probably a minute or two at most. However, this is an exercise you don't want to manage too closely, because cutting people off or interrupting is particularly bad during this kind of conversation. Okay, the personal histories exercise is good for helping people get comfortable being vulnerable and better understanding one another. But the real breakthroughs in terms of vulnerability and trust come when you introduce a behavioral profiling tool that allows team members to accurately and openly assess their strengths and weaknesses. Behavioral profiling. The idea here is simple. Give team members an objective, reliable means for understanding and describing one another. This provides two powerful benefits. First, it drastically increases the likelihood that team members will admit their weaknesses and strengths to one another. After all, once they voluntarily self-identify their type, they have little reason to resist opening up. In fact, I've found that they're usually eager and relieved to tell their peers who they are and why they act the way they do. Second, by providing team members with a common vocabulary for describing their differences and similarities, you make it safe for them to give each other feedback without feeling like they're making accusatory or unfounded generalizations. It is amazing to observe previously guarded team members calling out one another's strengths and weaknesses after having those strengths and weaknesses validated by an objective tool. Now, there are many profiling tools out there, such as the DISC, the Social Style Model, Right Path Profiles, and Insights, and I suppose that all of them have their advantages. However, my recommended favorite, and the one we use most often at the table group, is the Myers-Briggs Type Indicator, MBTI. Here's why. First and most important, the MBTI is valid and reliable. It has been tested for decades since its development in the 1940s by Isabel Briggs Myers, based on the insights of her mother, Catherine Cook Briggs. The amount of research and testing that has been done is staggering. Second, the MBTI is the most widely known tool out there. Normally, that would make me somewhat skeptical, as I wouldn't want people to do something just because everyone else is. But in this case, the popularity of the tool is important. That's because most of the executives we work with, more than 70%, are somewhat familiar with the MBTI and have taken part in a Myers-Briggs exercise at some point in their careers. And so they tend to accept its validity relatively quickly and can get up to speed with less time and effort than they'd spend on something new. Having to convince them to adopt the latest, greatest theory being developed by astrological surfers at UC Berkeley is going to severely reduce your chances of success. Another benefit of the popularity of the MBTI is the established vocabulary that exists among many, if not most, of the leaders we meet. Sometimes, within minutes of beginning a discussion of Myers-Briggs, someone will say, "I'm an ENTJ," and everyone around the room will nod their heads in unison and say, "No wonder." Advice on administering the MBTI. As good a tool as the MBTI is, and I suppose what I'm about to say applies to any tool for that matter, the way it is administered is critical to its success. That's probably why a certified or qualified instructor is required. A great tool done poorly will fail. A poor tool done well will probably fail, too. I guess the only thing to do is pick a good tool and do it well. Here are some tips. 1. Go fast. People are generally smart, and there is nothing like a slow lecture or a simplistic exercise to entice them to tune out and check their BlackBerries for messages. When in doubt, go faster and leave things out, rather than being overly concerned with covering everything up front. Better that they ask questions later for clarification than get bored. 2. Apply it to work. Every profiling tool is going to be based on a psychological behavioral theory. But the reason why you're talking to your clients or employees about it is so they can build trust and become a more highly functioning team at work. So don't bore them or even indulge them in too much theory. If someone in the room wants a lot of theory, and often there is someone who does, which tells you something about their Myers-Briggs type, then refer them to a book or website and move on. Get back to what all of this has to do with the way the team works. 3. Anticipate objections. Don't wait for someone to say, "Oh, this is a bunch of touchy-feely mumbo-jumbo." Instead, start by saying, "Now, for those of you who might be wondering if this is a bunch of touchy-feely mumbo-jumbo, let me say right now that I wondered the same thing when I first learned about this. And I can tell you, it was based in real data, and it is extremely practical for what we're trying to do here." Something like that. You get the picture. Demonstrate to your audience that you know and even understand what they might be thinking and take the issue off the table. It's simple, but surprisingly effective. 4. Know your stuff cold. That doesn't mean you have to impress people by showing them that you know your stuff cold, but it will help when there is pushback or when someone, usually an ENTP, tries to debate the merits of whatever tool you're using. My colleagues and I have had so many powerful experiences using the Myers-Briggs that it's hard to choose one or two to describe here. But here is a typical one. Behavioral profiling story. We facilitated an off-site with a team of executives from one of America's largest and most respected transportation companies. The average age in the room was higher than at most companies we work with, and as it turned out, we had the rare occasion to work with a team whose members were not terribly familiar with the Myers-Briggs. Now, this particular team hadn't yet become a real team. They were a collection of executives who had been amassed through acquisitions and reorganizations. Most of them felt their main sense of allegiance to the teams they led in their former companies, and didn't feel particularly loyal to the men and women sitting in the room with us on that day. In fact, it was worse than that. A few of them were actively trying to avoid giving up autonomy to the group, and were committed to retaining their own control. In short, there was little trust among them. Each member of the group had taken 20 minutes or so prior to our off-site meeting to complete an online Myers-Briggs assessment, but we didn't give them their results until later in the session. Instead, we spent the first half hour explaining the theory behind the Myers-Briggs and having everyone qualitatively assess themselves by answering a series of questions. This allowed them to make their first guesses at their types. Then we had them assess themselves again, this time by reading about something called temperament, which is based on the same theory as the Myers-Briggs. You might think that they'd already be growing impatient with yet another assessment, but it always amazes me how much people like to learn about themselves. They were now locked in the struggle of trying to figure out exactly who they were. Now, still less than an hour into the session, we handed out the results of their online assessments and asked them to compare those results with the two they had just completed to see if a pattern was beginning to emerge. Finally, we handed out a MBTI reference book that contains, among other things, one-page descriptions of each of the 16 types. It was at this point that some of the executives started saying things like, "Wow, where'd you get this? This is amazing." And, "This really nailed me. I hope my wife doesn't see this." Some of them just laughed in an emotional sort of way at how accurately Mrs. Myers and Mrs. Briggs had figured them out. But, of course, some of the executives still hadn't identified their type, or at least not with conviction. And so we asked them questions and suggested they read descriptions of some of the other types in the reference book. It is worth noting that no one in the room was questioning the validity of the tool at this point. They were all trying to apply it to themselves. And they were, every last one of them, having fun. Okay, now we'd been at this for almost 2 hours, and so we called the question. What are your types? We went around the room, starting with the team leader, and then with those people who were most confident of having identified their types, and had them read aloud their one-page MBTI descriptions. Here's where, as always, it got really fun. I will never get tired of watching the reticence and guardedness of untrusting teammates melt away as they acknowledge to one another what makes them tick. Without fail, there is laughter, teasing, relief, and insight. And that is exactly when the seeds of trust begin to grow. In this particular case, one of the quieter members of the group, someone who had perhaps the most reasons to resist giving up autonomy to the team, blew his prospective teammates away with his description of his own type. Half the room was smiling as they listened, nodding as if to say, "Aha!" The others were frowning, and when the 2-minute reading was over, they said, "I don't see you that way." This is common because in many cases, team members don't see the qualities that their colleague has just described precisely because that colleague hasn't been open or comfortable demonstrating them. In this case, the executive said, "No, this is definitely who I am. I'm actually more sensitive than you guys know." We then pointed out that because this guy has an introverting preference and a feeling preference, he tended to keep his emotions to himself. In fact, the team often thought he was holding back on purpose and hiding his political motives. When they realized that it was just his natural behavioral tendency that caused this, they were amazed and relieved. Similarly, another guy on the team was something called an ENFJ, which often indicates an emotionally excitable and passionate type. As soon as the group heard him read his type, they started laughing. "No wonder you're always being so dramatic," they good-naturedly teased. It was as though they were seeing him for the first time for who he really was. Then, the CEO read his type to the team. "It says here I'm impatient." "Well, that's definitely true." The room howled in laughter. Okay, the CEO admitted. "I'm extremely impatient." That provoked a lighthearted but important discussion of how he was able to shut down conversation by giving people the look. He went on to explain that he didn't want to bring discussions to a premature end, but that he just didn't know how to contain his desire for closure. The team agreed to push back more when this happened. Now, after everyone had read their types, we plotted the entire team's collective profile on the whiteboard so they could see what elements of their MBTI types were generally shared and which were missing. The insights into the collective behavior of the team and their resulting exposures were substantial. After approximately 2.5 hours of discussion and exercise around the Myers-Briggs, we moved on, not wanting to allow people to get impatient with the theory. But we kept the list of the team's types on the wall for reference, knowing that it would be referred to again and again throughout the remainder of the off-site. After the first day of an off-site, we usually ask team members to do a little homework. During the evening, we have them take a half hour or so to read a thorough description of their behavioral type and then come prepared the next day to report on the 3 or 4 areas that they felt were particularly insightful about their style. We also ask team members to identify one particular insight from their profile that they feel highlights a weakness that they would like to address for the good of the team. It is amazing to hear them call out behavioral issues about themselves that their peers would have struggled to raise. By the time an off-site has ended, a team will have come to know one another in a deeper, more meaningful way than ever, and they'll be feeling somewhat bonded to one another. Unfortunately, when they get back to work, some of this is bound to disappear in the business of day-to-day work. And that is precisely why it is critical to keep the Myers-Briggs and other profile-related learnings alive. There are a number of ways you can do this. Maintaining momentum. You can email everyone a list of the team members' types. This is helpful because if they don't remember one another's profiles, they aren't going to be able to use them. You should also encourage or even require that team members keep any reference material or collateral from the session on their desks back at work, rather than in a drawer or on a bookshelf. This increases the likelihood that they'll refer to it later and that others will ask them about it. And we always have team members go back to their direct reports and share their profile information. This serves 3 purposes. First, it provides a great opportunity for demonstrating vulnerability with their subordinates. Second, it gives those subordinates real insights into their leaders, so that they'll feel more comfortable providing feedback and interpreting behavior correctly. Third, it helps the executives develop a better understanding of their own profiles, because teaching is one of the best ways of learning. Beyond these initial steps, it's important that the team get together relatively soon after the initial offsite to discuss their types again and how they've used the information back at work. As with any new information, if it is not put to use and discussed, it quickly grows stale. Even a 30-minute session sometime within the first month after the offsite can be enough to keep the progress alive. Now, occasionally we work with a team with a member who isn't interested, willing, or capable of vulnerability-based trust. This poses a challenge for a team. Another story is probably worth telling here. The unyielding team member story. The head of sales for one particular executive team we worked with decided that vulnerability wasn't his thing. He announced to the team, "Listen, it took me years to trust my wife, so I wouldn't hold my breath waiting for me to trust you guys." Everyone laughed it off, but the CEO realized that this wasn't going to change without some work. So over the course of a few months, which he would later admit was a little too long, the CEO unsuccessfully pushed the sales VP to open up to the team and earn their trust. Finally, he managed the reluctant executive out of the company and was surprised to watch his team change almost overnight. The trust among the executives and the speed and quality of their decisions improved dramatically, all because of one person. And that is a testament to the power of vulnerability and the need for unanimity. Everyone on a team has to participate. That doesn't mean that everyone will do it the same way. But if even one member of a team is unwilling to be open about weaknesses, mistakes, and issues, it will have a profound impact on everyone else. Key points: building trust. Trust is the foundation of teamwork. On a team, trust is all about vulnerability, which is difficult for most people. Building trust takes time, but the process can be greatly accelerated. Like a good marriage, trust on a team is never complete. It must be maintained over time. Overcoming dysfunction number two. Mastering conflict. Once a team has begun the process of building trust, it's time to think about leveraging that trust. That's right. Trust is important because it is a requirement for overcoming the next dysfunction, which is the all-too-common fear of conflict. When I talk about conflict on a team, I'm talking about productive ideological conflict, passionate, unfiltered debate around issues of importance to the team. Any team that wants to maximize its effectiveness needs to learn to do this. And doing so can only happen if vulnerability-based trust exists. That's not to say that some teams that lack trust don't argue. It's just that their arguments are often destructive, because they are laced with politics, pride, and competition rather than humble pursuit of truth. When people who don't trust one another engage in passionate debate, they are trying to win the argument. They aren't usually listening to the other person's ideas and then reconsidering their point of view. They're figuring out how to manipulate the conversation to get what they want. Or worse yet, they're not even arguing with the other person face-to-face, but venting about them in the hallways after a meeting is over. In contrast, when vulnerability-based trust exists, team members say everything that needs to be said, and there is nothing left to talk about behind closed doors. The inevitability of discomfort. But this probably makes conflict sound too easy, too comfortable. The fact is, even among the best teams, conflict is always at least a little uncomfortable. No matter how clear everyone is that the conflict they're engaging in is focused on issues, not personalities, it is inevitable that they will feel under some degree of personal attack. It's just unrealistic for a person to say, "I'm sorry, Jan, but I don't agree with your approach to the project," and not expect Jan to feel some degree of personal rejection. But that is no reason to avoid conflict. In fact, if team members are not making one another uncomfortable at times, if they're never pushing one another outside of their emotional comfort zones during discussions, then it is extremely likely that they're not making the best decisions for the organization. One way for a team to know if they're having enough conflict is for them to think about how an outsider to the team would feel sitting in on a team meeting. A great team will look at least a little strange to an outsider who isn't accustomed to the direct and unfiltered dialogue taking place. Like a friend invited to dinner at a close family's house, they would probably be a little taken aback, at least at first. The fear of personal conflict. Now, many people often ask me, how do you avoid the conflict getting personal? The answer has a few different angles. First, based on my experience working with hundreds of executive teams, it is extremely rare that people attack each other openly on a personal level. In fact, I can recall only a handful of incidents in which a teammate stepped over the line, and even in those cases, it was relatively mild. The bigger problem I see among most teams is that they never get close to anything remotely resembling personal conflict. Think about conflict this way. Imagine a continuum. On one end, there is artificial harmony with no conflict at all. And on the other, there are mean-spirited personal attacks. In the exact middle of that continuum, there is a line where conflict goes from constructive to destructive, or vice versa, depending on which direction you're going. Now, the vast majority of teams I've encountered live close to the harmony end of the scale, fearing that any movement toward the middle is one step closer to murder. Theoretically, the best place on the continuum is close to the middle, just to the left of the dividing line. This is the point where a team is having every bit of constructive conflict possible without stepping over the line into destructive territory. In reality, however, this isn't possible. Even the best teams will rarely but occasionally step over the line. And that's not only okay, it actually can be a good thing, as long as they're committed to working through it. Because when a team recovers from an incident of destructive conflict, it builds confidence that it can survive such an event, which in turn builds trust. This is not unlike a husband and wife recovering from a big argument and developing closer ties and greater confidence in their relationship as a result. Tools and exercises. Okay, enough theoretical stuff. Let's talk about practical ways to go about helping your team get more comfortable with productive conflict. And the first thing your team will want to do is determine its conflict profile. Conflict profiling. Yes, we're back to profiling again, but in a different way. In order to teach a team how to engage in productive conflict, it's important to understand everyone's viewpoints on and comfort levels with conflict, because they can differ radically. On one extreme are the people who are comfortable screaming and shouting and arguing passionately. On the other are those who aren't comfortable airing the mildest of dissenting opinions out of fear of offending. It's important for the team to understand where people fall in this range and why they fall there, so they can establish a conflict culture that everyone understands and adjusts to. Someone's conflict profile is determined by a number of factors, not the least of which is their temperament or personality, which we talked about in the previous section and we'll get into again in a moment. However, other factors like cultural background and family norms usually have a significant impact too. In Japan, there is very little direct disagreement and debate during meetings. In Italy, emotional reactions will not be so rare. Even within a country, there are differences. Cultural New Yorkers will tend to get in one another's face more than cultural Californians. Of course, all of this can be trumped by family experience. Some people come from a background where parents and siblings rarely engaged in raw emotional dialogue. Others watch their parents argue passionately and then make up with equal passion. Which is better on a team? It doesn't matter. Regardless of whether a team tends to be more Japanese or Italian, New York or L.A., the only thing that really matters is this: are they holding back their opinions? Members of great teams do not. But again, to get to that point, team members need to understand one another's conflict profiles. And it should come as no surprise that one of the best ways to accomplish this is to use a tool like the Myers-Briggs and others that address conflict styles. The MBTI profile includes a very specific analysis about how each type deals with conflict. Having everyone on a team read their profile to their colleagues goes a long way toward clarifying the degree of difficulty of getting everyone on the same conflict page. How does a team go about figuring out its collective conflict profile? Like so many other aspects of team building and life, the best way to do it is simply to talk about it. Ask everyone on the team to read their own conflict profiles in the Myers-Briggs book or whatever other tool you're using, and then to discuss how that meshes with their personal views on conflict. Ask them to explain how their view of conflict was shaped by their childhood or maturation process. Most teams I've worked with are capable of accurate self-diagnosis. Listen, in my family we never argued. I never saw my parents fight. I prefer to keep things at a non-emotional level, even if that means giving in. Or maybe it's, I grew up with 8 kids in my family, and so I learned how to dish it out and take it from my older brothers and sisters. I'm not afraid of a fight, and 5 minutes after it's over, there are no hard feelings. Or something in between. The point here is that when people self-identify and publicly declare their outlook on conflict, they become much more open to adjusting it to whatever team norms need to be established. 2 other tools help teams identify their individual and collective conflict profile. One is the Thomas Kilman Conflict Mode Instrument, developed by 2 guys named Thomas and Kilman, which makes it a pretty good name, don't you think? It depicts different approaches to interpersonal conflict based on the importance of the task at hand and the relationships of the people involved. We've provided a description of the model in the Tools and Exercises segment. The other is something we created at the table group, and it's also called the Thomas Kilman instrument. No, that would be silly. We call it the depth-frequency conflict model, and it depicts how a team engages in conflict in terms of intensity and timing, It's also described in the Tools and Exercises segment. Conflict norming. What does a conflict norm look like? It should probably entail rules of engagement, and these can vary drastically. On one hand, I've worked with teams where people like to get emotionally charged, use colorful language, and interrupt each other during debates. They've come to the conclusion that this is productive and acceptable, and so people don't get offended by it. I've also known teams that try to keep discussions relatively objective and emotion-free. Which is better? That depends on the people involved. But one thing is certain. Having clear norms gives teams a huge advantage when it comes to ensuring the exchange of good ideas. Conflict norming story. I got to know an executive team that did a particularly good job setting conflict norms. They wanted a cohesive team so much, and understood how hard it is to achieve, that they drafted something they call the Team Effectiveness Charter. In it, they specified how they would engage one another. Among their various rules of engagement, we will address conflict-laden issues, put on the table, and get to the heart of issues about which we disagree or feel passionately. When discussing these issues, we will not withhold commentary. Every member of that team signed the Team Effectiveness Charter, and they bring it with them to meetings. When it comes to establishing a norm for a team, a measure of judgment is required of a leader. While there is no doubt that the person in charge must set the tone based on a personal belief about what will lead to the best results for the organization, the leader also needs to take into account the capabilities and attitudes of the staff members. This is something of a balancing act. Conflict culture story. I once worked with a team of automobile executives at a Japanese-American joint venture. Because the team was based in the United States, the predominant culture of the team was American. However, when it came time to engage in conflict and debate around sensitive issues, the team naturally allowed the Japanese members of the team to opt out of some of the exchanges. At times, they would ask them for their input in more general terms, and even then, there was much hemming and hawing and sucking of air through teeth, which is common among Japanese executives who aren't accustomed to direct and lively back and forth during formal meetings. Granted, this is an extreme case. For most teams, the differences in attitudes about conflict won't require such a drastic approach. In fact, in most situations, a leader will simply have to ask some team members to stretch, stepping up to a little more conflict than they're used to, and others to ratchet down their tendency to be more emotional and demonstrative. The key to all of this is involving team members in establishing the norms and then holding everyone accountable to what they've agreed upon. More detail about establishing conflict norms is in the Tools and Exercises segment. Mining for conflict. Okay. Once a leader has been clear about wanting more productive conflict among team members, and the team has set norms for how to go about it, progress isn't going to come easily. That's because people who don't like conflict have an amazing ability to avoid it, even when they know it's theoretically necessary. A cottage industry of psychotherapy is built around this phenomenon. So the leader is going to have to be ready to not only light the fuse of good conflict, but to gently fan the flames for a while, too. Here's what I mean. Even when norms have been set, most people will shy away from conflict when they aren't accustomed to it. And that's why a team leader must become a miner of conflict. What does that mean? It means the leader must seek out opportunities for unearthing buried conflict and forcing team members to address those issues. In some cases, this means almost stirring the pot, but only when there is a good chance that a real issue needs to be uncovered. Now, leaders who don't like conflict themselves might want to enlist the aid of the team members who are naturally more inclined toward mining. In any case, the key to mining is to ensure that important issues are not left beneath the surface, but dug for like the buried treasure that they are. Real-time permission. Even if a leader is adept at mining for conflict, there are still obstacles to overcome. That's because when a group of people who are not accustomed to having open, honest disagreement begin to do so, they are going to feel uncomfortable. Guilty, probably, too. And that is when a leader needs to do something that seems largely counterintuitive. Interrupt. As odd as it may sound, a leader should interrupt team members who are in the midst of an uncustomary debate simply to remind them that what they are doing is okay. I've done this many times, sometimes with senior executives of large companies, and frankly, I always feel somewhat paternal doing it. Excuse me, CEO Johnson and CFO Smith, I just want to remind you both that this argument you're having, though uncomfortable, is exactly what we've been talking about. This is good. Keep going. Something like that, anyway. That's when I think they're going to look at me and say, "We're adults, you idiot. Of course we know this is good." But they don't. In fact, and this is the whole point, they actually seem relieved. They shed whatever momentary anxiety they were feeling and resume the debate in a more comfortable, confident manner. I call it real-time permission, because I don't think it's enough to give people theoretical permission to engage in conflict. In the heat of the moment, even the most self-disciplined people will often balk. But when you give them explicit permission precisely at the moment they need it, they take it more to heart, and you've provided a valuable teaching moment. Meetings and conflict. For most teams, conflict is not something that happens every moment of the day, and indeed it shouldn't. However, there is one setting or arena where conflict must be apparent. Based on the subtitle of this section, you've probably already guessed that I'm talking about meetings. But why is conflict so important at meetings? Because the lack of conflict is precisely the cause of one of the biggest problems that meetings have. They are boring. Ask 100 employees to give you 3 words that describe meetings, and 99 of them are going to say boring, and it will probably be their first response. And so the questions we need to ask ourselves are these. Does it matter if meetings are boring? And do they have to be that way? The respective answers to these questions are yes and no. Boring meetings are indeed a big problem. The ultimate penalty of boring meetings is bad decisions, not to mention wasted time. When team members lose interest during a meeting, they fail to surface critical opinions, and they do not fully evaluate whatever opinions are aired. Moreover, they probably aren't even putting the right issues on the table for discussion, because they're more interested in getting out of the meeting on time, having already accepted that meetings are a waste of time anyway. But meetings are not hopeless. Team members can indeed become engaged in a meeting, but only when there is something at stake, a conflict worth caring about. It might be a conflict between the company and a competitor, or a conflict over how to use scarce resources, or a conflict about the best course of action to take to meet the needs of customers. And when team members passionately weigh in, suddenly the meeting gets interesting. How does a leader go about nurturing good conflict during meetings? They take a lesson from movies. Like meetings, all great movies must have conflict. either man versus man, like in Rocky. I use man to include both men and women here. Or man versus nature, like in Jaws or The Perfect Storm. Or man versus himself, like John Nash, struggling with his sanity in A Beautiful Mind. But it's not enough for a movie to have conflict. It has to give its audience a glimpse of that conflict right away. Screenwriters and directors refer to this as the hook. And that takes place in the first 10 minutes of every movie. When screenwriters or directors fail to hook an audience, they run the risk of losing people. And the same is true of meetings. Team leaders must give members a reason to care at the beginning of a meeting or discussion. They must raise the anxiety of the team about why the issues about to be discussed matter and what could go wrong if bad decisions are made. By doing so, they immediately get everyone engaged. Of course, then they must mine for conflict, keeping the issue alive until it has been resolved. Just like a movie audience, people who invest their energy and passion in a difficult issue have a need to achieve clarity and resolution. And when they do, an amazing sense of accomplishment and commitment results. But I'm jumping ahead now. And besides, all of this is described in more detail in a book called Death by Meeting, which I also happen to write. Conflict resolution obstacles. Okay, once you get your team more comfortable with conflict, you're going to find that they often struggle to achieve resolution around the issue they're discussing or debating. And while that is often a cue for you to step in and break a tie, in some cases, it is the result of an obstacle having nothing to do with the issue itself. What kind of obstacles am I talking about? Things like environmental obstacles, the physical environment where the conflict is taking place, relationship obstacles, an unresolved legacy event between the team members involved, and individual obstacles, an emotional or social deficiency on the part of one particular team member. When these obstacles present themselves, it is critical for a team, and especially its leader, to identify the distraction, even if it cannot be worked out at that moment, before attempting to resolve the original issue at hand. What is important is that the obstacle is acknowledged, so that it does not continue to cloud the conversation about the real issue. Key points. Mastering conflict. Good conflict among team members requires trust, which is all about engaging in unfiltered, passionate debate around issues. Even among the best teams, conflict will at times be uncomfortable. Conflict norms, though they will vary from team to team, must be discussed and made clear among the team. The fear of occasional personal conflict should not deter a team from having regular, productive debate. Overcoming dysfunction number 3. Achieving commitment. Like trust, conflict is important not in and of itself, but because it enables a team to overcome the next dysfunction, the lack of commitment. And like its predecessors, commitment needs to be correctly defined before it can be achieved. Teams that commit to decisions and standards do so because they know how to embrace two separate but related concepts, buy-in and clarity. Buy-in is the achievement of honest emotional support. Clarity is the removal of assumptions and ambiguity from a situation. Buy-in. Let me be crystal clear about something. Commitment is not consensus. Waiting for everyone on a team to agree intellectually on a decision is a good recipe for mediocrity, delay, and frustration. Which is why it amazes me that so many of the teams I work with still seem determined to achieve consensus. Ironically, commitment is something of the opposite. It's about a group of intelligent, driven individuals buying into a decision precisely when they don't naturally agree. In other words, it's the ability to defy a lack of consensus. The great teams I've worked with embrace disagreement and actually enjoy moments of temporary indecision. They take pleasure in making and rallying around and buying in to decisions when the right answer seems nowhere to be found. The key to making this happen has everything to do with conflict and leadership. When a group of people know that their colleagues have no reservations about disagreeing with one another, and that every available opinion and perspective has been unapologetically aired, they will have the confidence to embrace a decision and abandon whatever their initial opinion might have been. But of course, this assumes that someone has to break the tie. And that's one of the most critical roles of the leader. Good leaders drive commitment among the team by first extracting every possible idea, opinion, and perspective from the team. Then, comfortable that nothing has been left off the table, they must have the courage and wisdom to step up and make a decision, one that is sure to run counter to at least one of the team members, and usually more. The amazing thing about this is that 19.5 times out of 20, everyone sitting around that table will leave the room actively committed to implementing the solution that the leader has stipulated, even when that decision does not mesh with their own recommendation, even when it is diametrically opposed. How can this be possible? Because most human beings are drastically more reasonable than we think they are. In my work with teams, I've come to understand that most people don't really need to have their ideas adopted, aka get their way, in order to buy in to a decision. They just want to have their ideas heard, understood, considered, and explained within the context of the ultimate decision. Clarity. Unfortunately, even when teams master this ability to disagree and commit, this is something that the folks at Intel came up with years ago, they can still fail to benefit from their commitment. That's because many teams fail to achieve clarity and alignment around a decision. Instead, they make well-intentioned assumptions about what they've agreed to, and they end up creating confusion and frustration among employees who wonder whether their leaders are even talking to one another. I've seen this happen often, and it's worth describing. Lack of clarity story. At a large technology company I worked with, the CEO and his team had a meeting to discuss how to respond to a downturn in the company's revenue. After 2 hours of discussion and debate, the team left the conference room with a decision to freeze hiring until the company's bottom line had improved. The head of HR was charged with communicating the decision, and so she immediately sent out a note to all managers announcing the decision. Within 5 minutes of the note being sent, 3 of the 6 executives who had attended that meeting went to her office claiming, "I didn't think that applied to my organization. We can't freeze hiring in sales. That doesn't include product development, does it?" As this example demonstrates, commitment cannot occur if people are unclear about exactly what is being committed to. Unfortunately, this is not a rarity among many of the teams I've worked with. Tools and exercises. This problem with failing to align around commitments can easily be avoided by using two simple techniques I call commitment clarification and cascading communication. Here's how they work. Commitment clarification. With 5 minutes to go at the end of a meeting, any type of meeting, the leader of the team needs to call a question. What exactly have we decided here today? At the whiteboard, the leader writes down the decisions that the group thinks it has made. In many cases, team members see what the leader is writing on the board and react. Wait a second, that's not what I thought we agreed on. And so the group dives back into the conversation until everyone is clear. It is amazing to me how a group of intelligent, highly educated adults, all of whom speak the same language, can sit in a room for 2 hours of discussion and then leave the room under the false impression that everyone is on the same page. Such is the nature of nuanced communication, I suppose. In any case, by being extremely explicit about what has been agreed upon, a team will be able to identify discrepancies before a decision has been announced. Now, you might be wondering, but maybe team members are purposefully sitting back and allowing for ambiguity, preferring to later ask for forgiveness rather than permission. Read on. Cascading communication. To avoid that situation, the leader must also engage in cascading communication. That means demanding that the team go back and communicate the decisions to their staff members within 24 hours of the meeting. And not by email or voicemail, but either live, in person, or on the phone, thus giving employees a chance to ask questions for clarification. Even the most passive executives will call out their concerns about a decision if they know they'll be expected to go out and communicate it publicly. Of course, this assumes that if they don't communicate decisions to their people, the leader of the team will hold them accountable, which is a great setup for the next dysfunction. But before we go there, let's look at another example of failure to gain commitment. Lack of buy-in story. A pharmaceutical company I worked with was experiencing some profitability challenges and decided to cut costs. During an executive staff meeting, the CEO announced a proposal to eliminate business and first-class air travel for all employees. I was amazed and at the time impressed by the support from the other executives, many of whom logged thousands and thousands of air miles each year. Well, I later learned that only half the team went to their staff members and told them about the new rule. The others just decided to ignore it. You can imagine the problems this caused. Employees from different organizations getting on a transatlantic flight, some going merrily to the front of the plane, others slogging toward the back. Beyond the anger and frustration that this caused, the hit to executive credibility was undeniable. Could this have been a result of the teams proceeding without commitment clarification and cascading communication? In theory, yes. But in this particular case, as in so many, it came down to the unwillingness of those executive team members to stand up at the meeting and say, "This is really a terrible decision and I don't like it." Which brings us back to conflict. Because the only way for those executives to buy in to a difficult decision like that would have been for the CEO to demand honest, unfiltered debate. But that didn't happen because that particular group of executives had little or no trust. But now I'm moving backward within the model. Let's return to commitment. Committing to key principles. The examples I've provided thus far speak to relatively tactical issues. When it comes to commitment, the most critical issues that team members must align themselves around are more enduring. Certainly, this includes behavioral norms, which include but are not limited to conflict. Teams must commit to rules of engagement around timeliness at meetings, responsiveness in communication, and general interpersonal behavior. But beyond behavioral commitment, there is the commitment to other principles such as purpose, values, mission, strategy, and goals. For more information about commitment to these principles, consult the book The Four Obsessions of an Extraordinary Executive, which happens to be written by me. Now, depending on the nature of your team and its role in your organization, some of these principles will be more important than others. However, I've found that every team, regardless of its size or level, must be able to commit to common goals. Thematic goals. At any given time, all the members of a team should know what its top collective priority is and how they each contribute to addressing it. Achieving commitment around this is critical. Perhaps the best way to do this and to provoke team members to rally around a common cause is to help them establish something I call a thematic goal. This is nothing more than a single common unifying goal for the team, something that everyone on the team should be thinking about and working toward in the course of their daily responsibilities. The thematic goal story. I once worked with the executive team of a transportation company that had formed after a number of acquisitions of smaller firms over the prior 2 years. At the off-site meeting that I attended, the group determined that its thematic goal was to create a single company and work as one unit. That didn't mean that each division and each functional team would stop performing its duties. Sales would continue to sell, marketing would continue to market, operations would continue to run operations. But what it did mean was that all the team members would go about their own responsibilities in a way that contributed to the achievement of creating a single, unified organization. But the team members didn't stop there. They then identified the supporting objectives that would need to be accomplished for the team to say it had achieved the thematic goal: unifying the executive team, creating consistent business practices and policies, rationalizing different computer systems, creating a single brand and marketing message, establishing one approach to customer service and support. Only after establishing this thematic goal and the supporting objectives did the team begin to create metrics around each of these areas. This would later serve as part of the team's scoreboard for measuring progress during weekly team meetings. What is key here is that the team didn't start by committing to a set of metrics, but instead it created a context for those metrics. The members also didn't divide up responsibility for each of the supporting objectives according to everyone's titles. They took collective ownership for them. This sense of common cause and unification often has a powerful effect on everyone in an organization if the leadership team effectively cascades that message and demonstrates commitment to it. Now, at some point in the not-too-distant future, 3 months, 6 months, maybe a year, it will be time for the team to establish a new thematic goal. This will depend on a team's business cycle and the nature of change in a given industry. Key points: achieving commitment. Commitment requires clarity and buy-in. Clarity requires that teams avoid assumptions and ambiguity and that they end discussions with a clear understanding about what they've decided upon. Buy-in does not require consensus, members of great teams learn to disagree with one another and still commit to a decision. Overcoming dysfunction number 4. Embracing accountability. Accountability. It's a word that has become so overused and misused within the halls of many companies that it has lost much of its power. When it comes to teamwork, I define accountability as the willingness of team members to remind one another when they are not living up to the performance standards of the group. The key to this kind of accountability is that it shouldn't always require the participation of the team leader. It is direct, peer-to-peer accountability, and it is based on the notion that peer pressure and the distaste for letting down a colleague will motivate a team player more than any fear of authoritative punishment or rebuke. Ironically, for peer-to-peer accountability to become a part of a team's culture, it has to be modeled by the leader. That's right. Even though I said earlier that the best kind of accountability is peer-to-peer, the key to making it stick is the willingness of the team leader to do something I call enter the danger whenever someone needs to be called on their behavior or performance. That means being willing to step right into the middle of a difficult issue and remind individual team members of their responsibility, both in terms of behavior and results. But most leaders I know have a far easier time holding people accountable for their results than they do for behavioral issues. This is a problem because behavioral problems almost always precede results. That means team members have to be willing to call each other on behavioral issues, as uncomfortable as that might be. And if they see their leader balk at doing this, then they aren't going to do it themselves. I've found that senior executives at large companies are some of the most egregious violators when it comes to failing to hold people accountable for behaviors, large or small. The lack of accountability story. One particular CEO I worked with could not bring himself to confront one of his staff members who was publicly and unapologetically criticizing the leadership development program that the CEO himself was sponsoring. "That's just how he is," was his response to a request to confront the problem. Another chief executive claimed, "I don't have the time or energy for that," when someone suggested that he tell one of his direct reports to stop spreading unfounded rumors about his own promotion to president of the company. Neither of these two CEOs would be considered wimpy. They wouldn't hesitate for too long to fire an executive who wasn't producing. However, like most CEOs I've worked with, they just didn't like the thought of having to tell someone that they needed to behave better. Another lack of accountability story. I once attended a staff meeting where one of the executives had his laptop open and was intermittently typing away during discussions. After the meeting, I asked the CEO, "Does that bother you when he does that?" He told me, "Yeah, I find it distracting." So I asked the obvious question, "Why don't you tell him to stop?" A pained look came across the CEO's face as he answered, "I don't know. I'm not his parent. Who am I to tell him how to act?" I wanted to interrupt him and scream, "You're the friggin' CEO! That's who you are!" But I didn't. That's because I, too, sometimes struggle with accountability. Why are the team leader's actions so important when it comes to setting a tone? Because if the rest of the team knows that the leader will eventually step in and call someone on something, they won't feel like they're stepping over the line doing it themselves. "He's going to tell you eventually anyway, so I thought I might as well save you the time and trouble." But if everyone knows the leader doesn't have the courage to hold people accountable for their behaviors, they're going to reason with themselves, why should I play the heavy? Besides, he'll probably just let them off the hook eventually anyway. Finally, perhaps the most important challenge of building a team where people hold one another accountable is overcoming the understandable hesitance of human beings to give one another critical feedback. Sometimes the tightest teams are the most reluctant to do this, even when the feedback is clearly constructive, because they don't want to risk the positive emotional environment that exists, which they probably value greatly. Of course, when teammates stop holding one another accountable, what ultimately happens over time is that they lose respect for each other, and those good feelings begin to fade. Still, human beings often choose a path of slow, uncomfortable decline rather than risk a dramatic drop in morale caused by an ugly incident. I've found that the most effective way to overcome this hesitance is to help people realize that when they fail to provide peers with constructive feedback, they are letting them down, personally. By holding back, we are hurting not only the team, but also our teammates themselves. Sometimes this is the only compelling argument that can convince a well-meaning and caring teammate to step into the discomfort of telling someone what they need to hear. I know it works for me. Tools and exercises. Team effectiveness exercise. One of the best ways I've found to encourage a culture of peer-to-peer accountability on a team is a simple tool my colleagues and I call the Team Effectiveness Exercise, TEE. Before explaining the mechanics of the TEE, let me make it clear that this is an exercise for teams that have already built some trust and that have worked together long enough, 2 or 3 months at the least, to have formal observation-based opinions of one another. We use the TEE with almost every executive team we work with, and it's one of my favorite parts of the consulting we do. That's because it is both quick and amazingly effective. Here's how it works. During an off-site meeting, or any other session where you have well over an hour available, have everyone on the team write down their answers to 2 simple questions about every member of the team, excluding themselves. The first question: what is the single most important behavioral characteristic or quality demonstrated by this person that contributes to the strength of our team? The second: what is the single most important behavioral characteristic or quality demonstrated by this person that can sometimes derail the team? Once everyone has finished jotting down their answers, the facilitator starts by putting the leader of the team up first. One by one, the team members each read their positive quality of the leader. The leader cannot respond to any of the feedback other than to ask for clarification if something isn't clear. When everyone has gone, the facilitator asks the leader for any general reaction. Surprised, not surprised. In most cases, the answers from the team are remarkably consistent, not to mention graciously offered. And the leader, like everyone else, is amazed to realize that the team really does understand what he or she is good at and how it helps the team. Then the facilitator goes around the room, I like to go in the opposite direction, asking each member to provide their constructive feedback to the leader. Again, the responses are usually consistent and tactfully, graciously offered. And when everyone is finished, the leader again is asked for a general reaction. Usually the response is, "Yep, those are definitely my areas for improvement. Can't argue with that," or something of that nature. And the room is often slightly dumbfounded because they've just given their leader more direct, honest, and unequivocal feedback than they've ever offered before. Of course, now that the leader has served as a role model for the exercise, the rest of the team is up, one by one. This can take as long as 2 hours, but usually less. By the time the exercise is over, two separate but related feelings fill the room. The team members, even the difficult ones, are genuinely flattered by the specific positive feedback they've received. And they're collectively amazed by the clarity and simplicity of what they all need to do to improve for the team to grow. Pretty simple, pretty daunting, at least initially. But for a variety of reasons, this exercise yields amazing and powerful results virtually every time we use it. Here's why. There is not enough time for people to sit and think about their answers and wonder, what are they going to say about me? It happens so fast that people almost never game the process. The honesty is astounding. Because the leader goes first, it's tough for anyone to be defensive. Of course, this means the leader must do a good job of receiving feedback, both negative and positive. Because people are asked for just one positive and one negative, there is a sense of focus and priority, unlike many formal 360-degree programs that provide the victim with a list of 35 key improvement areas. Now, it's important to follow up the TEE so that the benefits of it don't fade quickly. The first way to do this is to have all team members email their areas of strength and areas for improvement to the team leader. Then, a few months after the session where the exercise took place, the team should review those areas and discuss them again. What's critical is that team members know that the areas that were identified will not go away, and that they will have to answer for their progress in the not-too-distant future. Meetings and accountability. While a sense of accountability should pervade virtually every aspect of organizational life at a great company, the place where it must be demonstrated and addressed most clearly is meetings. And there are two important steps in making this happen. First, team members must know what each of the others is working on in order to hold them accountable. The best way to do this is to do something I call the lightning round at the beginning of regular meetings. This entails asking team members to each take no more than 30 seconds to update the team about their three top priorities that week. If anyone on the team feels that a given team member is spending time unwisely, or that there is greater need for a person's time and energy in another area, this is the place to call the question. Of course, as always, this assumes a level of trust, an openness to conflict, as well as an original commitment to the team's goals. Second, and more important still, the team must track progress against its goals and highlight any shortcomings before they become problematic. A great way to identify those shortcomings is to keep the team focused on a scoreboard or radar screen where key goals, thematic goals, and supporting categorical objectives are tracked. I'll be explaining the concept of the scoreboard in the next section, which happens to be right now. Key points. Embracing accountability. Accountability on a strong team occurs directly among peers. For a culture of accountability to thrive, a leader must demonstrate a willingness to confront difficult issues. The best opportunity for holding one another accountable occurs during meetings, and the regular review of a team scoreboard provides a clear context for doing so. Overcoming dysfunction number 5. Focusing on results. Okay, if team members trust one another, engage in healthy conflict around issues, commit to the decisions they make, and hold one another accountable for those decisions, there is a pretty good chance they're going to make it. Unfortunately, when we build teams, we rarely, if ever, go about it in a linear, chronological way. For instance, I don't wait until my clients have completely addressed all of the first four dysfunctions before moving on to the fifth. But even if we could, even if a team had overcome each dysfunction and seemed on the verge of the Teamwork Hall of Fame, there isn't one, by the way, there would still be a chance that it would stumble and lose sight of the ultimate measure of a great team, results. And that's because your team is made up of extremely fallible human beings. What is it about us that makes it so hard to stay focused on results? It's this thing called self-interest and self-preservation. We have a strong and natural tendency to look out for ourselves before others, even when those others are part of our families and our teams. And once that tendency kicks in on a team, it can spread like a disease, quickly eroding the roots of teamwork until eventually even trust has been destroyed. How do we avoid this? The key lies in keeping results in the forefront of people's minds. There is a reason that old saying, out of sight, out of mind, is used so often. It's true. A good way to focus attention is to use a visible scoreboard of some kind. Why a scoreboard? Consider a football team. On a football field, a scoreboard focuses everyone's efforts on one thing, winning. It doesn't display defensive statistics or offensive statistics or individual player statistics. It provides unambiguous information about how the team is doing and how much time the members have left if they want to improve the final outcome. That leaves little room for individual interpretation. Imagine the quarterback of a team that is losing by 14 points with 3 minutes to go in the game, saying to the coach, "Well, I feel pretty good about things. I mean, my performance was not bad, and my stats look good." The coach would be furious. He wants that quarterback and everyone else on the team to be focused on one thing, winning. And the only thing a team has to do to know whether it's winning is to look at the scoreboard. Teams within organizations need to do the same thing. They have to eliminate ambiguity and interpretation when it comes to success. It's ironic that so many teams don't do this, because they have an advantage over sports teams. They often get to create their own scoreboard. They decide what it is they want to achieve and how they want to measure their success. Certainly, many large and public companies don't have the same kind of luxury because they're accountable for quarterly numbers and a stock price. But even those companies, and certainly the smaller ones, get to decide how they want to go about running their businesses. And even within large public companies, the departmental teams that make up the company have a say in what they do. And that means they construct their own scoreboards. But should they measure their team's success in terms of market share, client satisfaction, pure revenue, profit, growth over last year, growth versus competitors, versus the industry average, key milestones? There are only two consistently wrong answers. None of the above, and all of them. Pick one, or maybe two, but by all means, pick something so that team members have something they can collectively focus upon and around which they can rally. Far too many teams assess their success using subjective and unreliable means like politics. Is the CEO happy with us this month? Feelings. I feel like we're doing pretty well right now. Or outside opinion. Did you see what that analyst wrote about us in his industry report? But none of this really matters. Results-oriented teams establish their own measurements for success. They don't allow themselves the wiggle room of subjectivity. But this is not easy, because subjectivity is attractive. I know how easy it is to fall into this trap, because I do it myself. I don't like to be limited in how I measure my success to a few numbers that might not tell the whole story. But I know that this is just an excuse, or better yet, a manifestation of my desire to change my mind and reinterpret my success based on what's going on at a given point in time. Ultimately, ambiguity and loose interpretation catch up to you, usually in the form of the bottom line. So how does a team avoid this pitfall? By committing, early and publicly, to what it will achieve, and by constantly reviewing its progress against those expected achievements, a.k.a. the scoreboard. If it's a regular meeting where the key metrics are reviewed and discussed, great. If it's an online scoreboard where every major goal is tracked, terrific. If that's a piece of butcher paper on the wall with the updated numbers, good enough. But remember, this isn't about measuring everything. That creates just as much confusion by overwhelming people. This is about giving people a simple way to gauge their success and to stay focused on the right priorities so that they aren't distracted by something else. Distractions. What might that something else be? How about their individual career advancement, or their compensation, or their ego, their standing within the department? When players on a team stop caring about the scoreboard, they inevitably start caring about something else, and that something else is usually not the team. The individual over the team story. Years ago, when basketball superstar Michael Jordan retired for the first time from the Chicago Bulls, a great player, Scottie Pippen, became the leader of the team. Even without Jordan, the Bulls were considered one of the best teams in the league and had just as much chance to win the championship as anyone else. During the playoffs that year, the Bulls were tied with their rival, the New York Knicks, with just a few seconds to go in the game. The coach of the Bulls called timeout and drew up a set play for his team to take the final shot of the game. His play called for that shot to be taken by a player other than Pippen. Disappointed that he wouldn't be playing the key role in deciding the game, Pippen refused to go out on the court for the last few seconds. Fans and announcers, not to mention the players themselves, were dumbfounded. In essence, Pippen was announcing to the world, and certainly to his teammates, that the collective results of the team were not as important as his own stardom. The Bulls made their shot and won the game. And to his credit, Pippen went into the locker room after the game and took his lumps from his teammates, later admitting that what he had done was wrong. And just in case we're tempted to believe that this would never happen in a corporate environment, consider the following examples. The second individual over the team story. A client's products were becoming obsolete, and the CEO announced to his team that they would need to focus on innovation in order to prevent an imminent revenue problem. The chief scientist of the company, whose job it was to run research and development, seemed less than enthusiastic about the charge. When pressed, he finally admitted, "I don't get paid enough to innovate. I want to get paid royalties for what I invent." Yet another individual over the team story. Another client, this one a startup, had just hired its final executive team member, a highly sought-after chief technology officer. When the CEO indicated that everyone in the company should be willing to do whatever was necessary to make the company fly, including sweep the floors, the CTO replied, "I don't have near enough stock to sweep floors." In both of these situations, the difficult executives quickly left their teams. The point of these stories is that human beings are naturally self-interested. Only by ensuring that the people on your team are committed to collective results ahead of their own needs, and by keeping them focused on those results, can you avoid the kind of individualization that breaks teams apart. Because these self-oriented distractions are such powerful destroyers of teams, it is worthwhile to look at and understand them all. Distraction number one. Ego. Ego is the ultimate killer on a team, and it is an insidious one. That's because it lurks deep in the heart of every team member. As much as we want our teams to win, at a basic level, we want to win as individuals first. As a kid, I remember playing on some bad Little League teams, but making the All-Star team. If you had asked me then if I would have traded my All-Star status for a few extra wins, I'd probably have said, no way. As an adult, I've been fortunate to learn to enjoy the collective benefits of team accomplishments more than individual ones. But there is always that little voice in your head saying, what about me? Sometimes that little voice drowns out the cry of the team, and the collective results of the group get left behind. I've worked with many executive teams that were failing as a group, but somehow the majority of the people on the team seemed to be in good spirits. Looking under the covers, I discovered that only the individuals who were failing were unhappy. It was as though the others were saying, well, at least my area is doing well. This is probably one of the top two or three things that separate good teams from bad ones. On strong teams, no one is happy until everyone is succeeding, because that's the only way to achieve the collective results of the group. Of course, this implies that individual egos are less important than team achievements. Distractions number two and three. Career development and money. Even the most altruistic team members will at times have to focus on their own career advancement and financial needs. After all, they have families, mortgages, and tuition payments to think about. A great team will understand those needs and the validity of them, but will not let them distract the team from achieving the collective goals. The key to doing that is being open about what people need, and not making them feel guilty or selfish for acknowledging those needs. That might sound unrealistic, but remember, if team members trust one another, then they're willing to be vulnerable. And admitting that you're uncomfortable with your career advancement or salary or anything else that is personal is nothing if not a statement of vulnerability. If there is trust among team members, no one will take the comment as selfish or anti-team. In fact, they should be glad that the person put the issue on the table for everyone to help with, because if they don't, then it will eventually fester and create problems that impact the team's performance. And after all, the performance of the team is what matters. Anything that stands in the way of performance must be addressed openly and directly, even if it is something that is sensitive to one or more members of the team. Distraction number four. My department. This is perhaps the most subtle and dangerous distraction of all, because well-intentioned team members often succumb to it, and because they actually wear it as a badge of honor. The departmental distraction is the tendency of team members to place a higher priority on the team they lead than they place on the team they are a member of. I call this the team number one dilemma. The team number one dilemma. Give a group of team members some truth serum and ask them which is their first priority, the team they manage or the team they're a member of, and many of them will admit that it is the team they lead. And when you think about it, this makes sense. After all, they probably hired, aka picked, the people on their team. They might very well spend more time with them. As a result, they will probably like their own team more. They probably feel a sense of responsibility for their team and convince themselves that their people would feel betrayed or abandoned if their leader felt a slightly stronger allegiance to the team above than to the one below. In reality, employees want their leaders to be strong team members on the teams above. They know that they ultimately pay the price when their manager doesn't get along with or cooperate with managers of other departments, leaving the staff to navigate the treacherous and bloody waters of organizational politics. In truth, many leaders who choose the teams they lead over the ones they belong to are doing so because they like being leaders more than they like being followers. As understandable as this is, it is a recipe for team disaster. When members of a team fail to make that team more important than their own teams, they create something I like to call the United Nations syndrome, or you can call it the congressional syndrome. Rather than coming together to make the best possible decision for the entire organization, they become lobbyists for their own constituents. In essence, whenever push comes to shove, they compete with their teammates rather than collaborate with them. Now, this is usually okay for the United Nations or Congress, groups that are explicitly not teams. The founding fathers of the United States, for instance, recognized what they called self-interest rightly understood and created a government that respected it and provided a sense of balance. Okay, that's the end of today's civics lesson. A team, however, is a different kind of institution. The key to success for a team is that its members go beyond barter and compromise to embrace a collective pursuit of the best interests of the whole. Like a family, they make sacrifices for one another with the only expectation of repayment being greater team success. They offer up their own headcount, budget, accolades, and prestige without hesitation or complaint. Why? Because their sense of self-esteem and achievement is not individual, but rather collective. If you stop and think about that for a moment, it is pretty powerful. How does a group of people who are more interested in their own individual needs compete against such a team? They usually lose. Tools and exercises. Scoreboard. There is one simple method for ensuring that a team doesn't lose sight of results, the scoreboard. Some teams may call this a dashboard, a radar screen, or even just a list of metrics. In any case, every team should have a single, easy-to-read visual tool for assessing its success at any given point in time. The components of that scoreboard will vary depending on the size and scope of a team, not to mention the industry. However, a good scoreboard will be limited to a relatively small number of critical factors, and while it will be largely quantitative, revenue, expenses, schedules, and so on, it should incorporate an element of qualitative assessment on the part of the team. The best way to create a scoreboard is to draw upon two primary sources: the ongoing metrics of the team, again, revenue, expenses, schedules, customer service numbers, and the like, and the supporting objectives, which form the team's thematic goal. Aside from the creation and publication of a team scoreboard, there is no real activity or tool for ensuring results. The best tools and exercises for doing this are the ones that ensure trust, conflict, commitment, and accountability, because these will ultimately pave the way for team success. Key points. Focusing on results. The true measure of a great team is that it accomplishes the results it sets out to achieve. To avoid distractions, team members must prioritize the results of the team over their individual or departmental needs. To stay focused, teams must publicly clarify their desired results and keep them visible.